Hello and welcome to The Bookmonger. I'm John J. Miller of National Review. Thanks for listening. This show is a production of National Review, and we're recording from the studio WRFH, the campus radio station of Hillsdale College. Our guest is Mike Pitts, author of How to Build Stonehenge. Mike, welcome to The Bookmonger.
It's a pleasure to be here, John.
Let's start with a quick reminder about Stonehenge. Where is it? When was it built? And what do we know about its purpose?
Those are big questions. It's in the centre of southern England, in a county called Wiltshire, which is a rural place. So this monument, and it's one of the things that's always drawn people to it, stands unexpectedly, almost in the middle of nowhere. It was built between around 3000 and 2500 BC, so 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. As far as why Stonehenge was built, I think it'd be fair to say we don't actually know anything, and we're guessing. And there are huge numbers of guesses. I mean, just a few weeks ago, an archaeologist friend of mine published a peer-reviewed article suggesting that Stonehenge was built as a giant calendar. And there have been suggestions, all kinds of things. The same archaeologist had previously suggested it might have been a place of healing. There have been ideas about it being computer, to do with astronomy, to various types of political, social activity. I think whatever Stonehenge was and what it meant to people, at the time it was built even, I suspect there were many ideas and confusions about it. It has to have been a big political, social project fundamentally.
So that's the where, the when, the why, or what we know about the why. But your book is about the how of Stonehenge. It's called How to Build Stonehenge. What drew you to this topic?
I mean, it goes back to when I had just finished at university, and I found myself by accident, long story, excavating at Stonehenge, directing a small excavation at Stonehenge. And I discovered that everything I thought we knew about Stonehenge was actually questionable, and I was drawn into the history of the monument and its archaeology. And I've been following it ever since. And the big question, it seemed to me, that archaeologists never really address properly is this one of how it was built. We spend a lot of time thinking about when and who did it and why, but the how has not really been addressed in a book for nearly a century. And it seemed to me this was a good time to do this because there's been a fair bit of new research that helps us address this issue. In particular, there have been some substantial new work over the past decade done by scientists looking at the origins of the stones, where the stones came from. Because famously, one of the strange things about Stonehenge is that many of the stones, not all of them, but many of them come from Wales, a good 200 miles from the site. And those sources have now been pinned down, and so we can actually look at drawing lines on maps from potential quarries to the site. There have also been, amazingly enough, the first proper study of the monoliths themselves, the shape and surface finishes of the stones, that was done a decade ago. And that, from that, we learned a lot of new stuff about how the stones have been carved, much more intensively than we'd realised, and how much they weigh, which interestingly was generally less than people had imagined them to be. And there's been another study on the sources of the really big stones, which are not blue stones from Wales, but a sandstone from within 20 miles of Stonehenge. But they are so big, 20 or 30 tons, that the effort and the organisation, the challenge of getting those to the site, I think would have been much greater than the longer journey of the smaller blue stones.
What kinds of technology did the builders have available? Did they have metal tools and wheels and bulldozers and cranes, or what were they using?
Well, let's start with the certainty. They did not have bulldozers. Whether or not they had metal tools is questionable, but I think if they did, they would have been soft copper or gold and not really tools, more trinkets than precious objects. So we're really at the end of the Stone Age. So these are Neolithic people building Stonehenge. And what's important about that is that they actually really understand stone. They understand stone technology. Now, most of the time, they're using that. They're applying that on a small scale to make tools and weapons and grinding stones for creating flour and paints and so on. And what they do at Stonehenge is they apply that understanding to these really big stones to shape them and dress them and move them about and engineer them. And they have really good understanding of wood technology as well. So we know from preserved material that they're good at making timber trackways, that they're good at making boats. And there are boats that are not quite as old as Stonehenge, but nearly. And given naval technology is not something you change on a whim because of the obvious safety issues, that I think we can assume that the boats that we do have are similar to the ones that would have been made by the people who built Stonehenge. And the point about these boats is that they show a quite sophisticated understanding of issues of stress and engineering technology that would have been necessary to create what I think would be substantial sledges, and for all the engineering required in moving the stones about, standing them up and shaping them and engineering them together. So they've got this package of understanding from that they're usually using in different social contexts, but they can bring together to focus on this unique stone monument.
What's the hardest thing they did? Was it the carving, the transport, the standing up of the stones? What's the most challenging test they faced?
That's a really interesting question. I think there are two candidates to that. First is to move the big stones to the site, 15, 20 miles, fairly simple landscape. But the stones are so big, and there's 75 of them. I think they would have needed to have constructed a permanent trackway, a solid wooden trackway. So for 15, 17 miles, that's a massive undertaking. And moving those stones along that track is something that would have it would have been a phenomenon of not just an engineering one, not just a logistical one, but a social and cultural one that I think would have reverberated across Europe at the time. And I think that transport process of planning it and executing it, I think it is definitely one of the most challenging things they addressed. The other thing I think is probably to erect safely and permanently the really biggest stones. And they're arranged in groups of two with a lintel on top, with a third stone, horizontal stone on the top, on a kind of horseshoe plan in the centre of the monument. And the uprights are absolutely massive. And to engineer those into position and to get the tops perfectly level to take these jointed lintels, I think, is an extraordinary achievement. And at the time, probably was the one that people most pointed to and said, look at this, that we've done this. I mean, how did that happen?
As an architectural marvel, where does Stonehenge rank? I'm thinking there are other megalithic structures in the UK and around Europe. We have the pyramids in Egypt. There are the statues of Easter Island. Where does Stonehenge fit into this tradition of stone monuments?
I'm not sure I'd rank them, but it definitely is part of that world. I mean, within stone monuments in northwest Europe, and particularly across Britain, where stone circles are really quite common, Stonehenge definitely stands out as something quite unique and monumentally large and impressive. But when you visit Stonehenge, particularly if you're privileged enough to be able to get access to the centre of the monument, which we can all do, it just takes months sometimes of planning, but it is possible for anybody to do that. The experience you have, this sort of sense of awe and mystery and engagement with people in the past about whom we know actually very little, is, I think, I find it similar to the experience one has walking through a great medieval cathedral or visiting the pyramids in Egypt or wandering around the statues on Easter Island and other similar locations. I mean, the experience is just wonderful. It's one of those great things that we as humans, if you like, are able to enjoy. This engagement with antiquity and with the monumentality of the achievements of past people, reminding us that people in the past were as clever and as imaginative and ingenious as we are today.
One more question as we wrap up. We've learned so much about Stonehenge in recent years, and now we have your book. But what mysteries remain? What do you want to know about this place, and what might we learn soon?
I mean, in a sense, everything about Stonehenge remains a mystery, but I think there are two particular areas that are absolutely fascinating at the moment. The first is the simple issue of the monument itself. For example, a few years ago, there was a drought And in grass that dried out and died, we could see a ring of pits around the megaliths that we knew nothing about before. That hasn't been investigated. What is it? When, you know, when were those pits dug? Why are they there? There are many issues like that about the monument, basic ones that we still do not understand. The other thing, and this is, I think, really interesting that's happening at the moment, is as a result largely of ancient DNA research, we're beginning to get a picture of the time when the big Stonehenge was built, the final monument, 2500 BC, that suggests there was substantial movement of people going on around Europe. And in particular, there was a very substantial migration of people into Britain to the point where the existing indigenous genome was almost entirely replaced. Now, the issue is we don't know exactly when these people started to come into Britain on a large scale, and we don't know exactly when that big Stonehenge was built. So was it a response to these cultural changes from an indigenous population that were a fearing change and were trying to consolidate ancestral traditions and to make a statement about their authority in the face of threatened changes? Or was this something that was actually implemented by an immigrant population making its mark on a new land? I mean, I think it's a really interesting big question that I think we're going to get closer to over the coming years.
The author is Mike Pitts. The book is How to Build Stonehenge. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to all of you for listening. If you enjoyed this show, please take a minute to leave a review. Your reviews help new listeners discover us, and that helps us keep this show going. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Bookmonger.